Thank you, Chair. I wish to thank my friend Alam Ahmed, WASD, to provide me this opportunity to interact with the most distinguished scholars here. I want to begin by saying that biomedical innovations are the future. Stem cell innovation is the future. In the 20th century, we saw a very big antibiotic revolution that neglected the biological diseases. So biomedical innovation and stem cell innovation provide this opportunity to treat biological diseases. There are many debilitating diseases that stem cell promise to cure through various therapies. So now the question is that we have lost one opportunity in the 20th century for epistemic sovereignty. Now whether this biomedical innovation, the bioeconomics, can provide us this opportunity. Dr. Nurse was talking about global crisis, economic decline, and epistemic sovereignty this afternoon. So whether, you know, this kind of economic recovery and the epistemic sovereignty that the developing countries are striving to achieve, whether bioeconomy, bioeconomic revolution is a solution to this problem. Given the fact that the developing countries have vast biological resources, rich in biodiversity, large genetic pool, and moreover, the traditional knowledge combined together, whether we can attain this epistemic sovereignty. So in that context, let us see how this stem cell innovation system in India is working that promises to cure so many diseases, whether it will become accessible to common people, and whether, you know, and what exactly is stem cell innovation system? Innovation system, as you are aware, you know, it involves various actors, institutions. So in stem cell innovation system, who are the actors and what are the agencies and how it compares with other stem cell innovation system in the world, and what are the barriers and what are the opportunities available to us. As far as India is concerned, this sector is in nascent stage, but it has witnessed a very rapid growth. Worldwide also, this market has touched $1 billion market. You can see it is estimated that by 2015 it can touch even 100 billion. And even Indian market is growing at the rate of 15%, which is very high. And that government has also invested lots of money that might not be adequate for the requirement that we have, but there are lots of government interventions here. And most part of the world, you know, this innovation system is being supported by the government. However, there are several contentious issues of socio-economic, political, and ethical in nature. And that, we'll discuss how it provides different environment and whether it promotes or inhibits the growth of stem cell innovation research. And that if you look at this as a co-evolution of technology and institution that is yet to emerge, like in any other developing country, the institutions are lagging behind the technological growth. The analytical framework we have used here is sectoral system of innovation, and also the linkages between international system of innovation system. I don't see any contradiction between different perspectives like national innovation system or structural system of innovation and what I would call international system of innovation, and the linkages between are actually more important than that there are contradiction between different perspectives, and by using the conceptual framework or ISI, there are many elements that NIS would ignore can be, incorporated, like inward and outward FDI, technology transfer, technology trade, technology licensing. So I'm not, I don't wish to spend more time here. I will skip and go to structure of stem cell research in India. So broadly, the stem cell innovation system in India is dominated by the public sector. You have several actors. You have public sector research labs, you have universities, you have hospitals where this kind of research is going on. But at the moment, universities are playing a moderate role, and it's dominated by public sector institutes. And given the fact that they are dominated by public sector institutes and not by universities, there are all likelihood that it will be dominated by Zeynmanian norms rather than Mertonian norms, meaning that there will be more patenting than publishing, and that greater attempts to commercialize rather than keeping knowledge universal. So there are several academic institutions, there are hospitals that do stem cell cord blood banking. The reason, simple reason, is that cord blood banking is technologically not as complex. So you see lots of activities in hospitals. Now, as far as publications are concerned, I just want to give you an international comparison. India, we have not seen a spectacular growth as far as publication is concerned. We are at the bottom of, about 7-8 top countries that we have here. But you can see a spectacular growth in publication as far as China is concerned. There's a sudden jump in China as far as publication in this sector is concerned. And the reason is that there's a conscious policy of Chinese government to support publications, and the policy is more inclined towards its application rather than patenting. So patent pattern, you can see the global patent pattern here. United States still remains at the top, though you know you might see some decline, but that has not changed the entire picture. And that you know, India, you can see, is you know even registering more patents than China. So this is the international situation, and there are definite reasons, and there are definite implications for U.S. Dominating the scene. And then, you know, as far as, again, our basic question of epistemic sovereignty is concerned, whether we can attain that when, you know, there is a single country or a dozen countries that dominate the entire patent system. So there are several research labs in the country. There are public sector research labs all around the country. I'm not going into details of what all these centers are. You know, you can always get the details from the paper, and that, you know, there are hospitals like AIIMS and other major hospitals, but not only the major Indian hospitals, even many private hospitals are indulging in stem cell applications and even research. Also, some of them are involved in clinical trials. And the fact that, you know, we have a large patient pool that's, you know, a positive aspect here that will drive the innovation system. You know, you have, you know, all kinds of hospital, ophthalmological hospitals and the different kind of hospitals that are doing all kinds of research. And that the several private firms have also emerged. Major firms are Reliance Life Sciences, and then the Stamputics, another private research. And the fact that many of them have collaboration with hospital or universities, and so they are also, you know, you also have domestic knowledge network. And then in addition to this, there are many other multinationals. You have Japanese that have entered, Chinese, and of course the other known multinationals like Johnson & Johnson and Glaxo, and many of them, they have entered their research field here. And several of universities that are doing this research, I'm not going into the details. The other important element here in innovation system is the role of institutions. And as far as the role of institutions are concerned, you know, the major players are Department of Biotechnology, the Indian Council of Medical Research, DST, and CSR. Of course, DBT has a major responsibility here. And DBT, you know, has, you know, a role of promoting this sector. ICMR is more into the regulatory aspect, the ethical guidelines, etc. And DBT is already supporting 55 stem cell programs. And another major point that I would like to emphasize here in the policies and the role of institution is that they are promoting city cluster program, and as many as half a dozen cities, they have promoted the city cluster program, and that again, you know, intensify the collaboration process through which technological learning takes place. And the major policy, the major planks of Indian policy is the development of skilled and brilliant pool of scientists and attract scientists of Indian origin. China is also, Chinese policy also, you know, is one of the major planks. I'll wind up in 2 minutes. And they have, you know, the sea turtle policy has attracted many scientists. Similarly, India also, we have, you know, Ramalinga Swami Fellowship. There is also policy to set up an exclusive institute in this area. And international collaboration, of course, there are some problems in spite of the fact that, you know, the government allows 100% FDI in R&D as well as health-related. You know, you have to take permissions at several levels. But now they are going. Very soon they are going to have one window clearance with the authority, biotechnology authority being established. Then I already discussed the FDI situation. And I'm not going into, I'm running out of time, so I'm not going into the emerging scenario. But I would like to wind up by saying that what is the solution now? You know, if the global innovation system in this sector, if it is dominated by United States or, you know, a half a dozen countries. So there are many barriers to this commercialization. Of course, there are certain positive features also. So one has to evolve an alternative funding and patenting strategies to promote this sector. And in many other areas, you have examples of alternative models like prize fund, advanced market commitments, patent pool, global R&D treaty, university industry R&D that helps reducing the cost. So that is another alternative one can think of which can enhance the access of common people. And there are legislations like public funded R&D project bill tax credit for integrating cost reduction. And so the context here is the increasing interdependence, increasing patent thicket, and overlapping patent claims in the basic areas. I'll show you how the patent ticketing takes place. You can see there that the darker areas are the basic areas, and the other areas are dependent on them. And when you have patenting in the basic areas, the further research is blocked here, and that is what is happening. So whether, you know, alternative strategies like compulsory licensing will work, or the other strategies that I have talked about, you know, patent pooling, and so yet, you know, there are many issues that that we require to resolve before we can really think of promoting this sector. Thank you very much.
I'm so sorry to do this. I'm so sorry to cut you. Interestingly enough, we had a little session. I'm from University of Trinidad and Tobago, not UWE. I have nothing against UWE, but I'm with UTT. And we had a little session sometime last week. And everybody was given 5 minutes to present. And then a steel pan started to play at the end of your 5 minutes. And if you could talk above the steel pan, then you could continue to talk. But of course, most people stopped at the 5 minutes, so we probably need to try that the next time around. So Mr. Dodson is now going to present on opportunities for the use of computer-assisted instruction in secondary schools in Guyana.
Yes, good afternoon. And my presentation is entitled Opportunities for the Use of Computer-Assisted Instructions in Enhancing the Quality and Coverage of Education Delivery at the General Secondary School Level. This paper, the main thesis for this paper is that ICT holds tremendous opportunities for enhancing the quality and coverage of public goods in developing countries. By the year 2003, Guyana achieved Millennium Development Goal number 2, and consequently embarked on a policy of universal secondary education. Now, studies have shown, and there are two examples there, that there's a direct correlation between the accomplishment of youth using youth. The Millennium Development Goals, at the 2000 Millennium Summit, we set ourselves 8 goals, 7 or 8 thereabout, and none of them said anything about quality, nor what happens after we have accomplished them. So it is within that context that this paper has to do with sustainable development. The question is, can we sustain the accomplishment regarding the goals we set ourselves? So sustainable development here is looked at within, not within the context of your environment, but within the context of being able to sustain these accomplishments. Now, Guyana set out to achieve youth by embarking on a amalgamating strategy that's bringing together the lower and upper secondary schools together. Prior to 2003, we had a two-tier secondary education system following different programs. What we have now is one general secondary school, one system, following one program, which is the CSEC program, the Caribbean Secondary Education Council Examination Program. As reflected in that strategy also, youth is a matter of quality more than quantity. And the measurement here was passes at the CSEC exam in more than at least 5 subject areas at proficiency level between grades 1 to 3 in one sitting. But yes, when you look at the data, and this is common to many Caribbean countries, and we speak a lot about science and technology and innovation. But if you look at the main scientific areas, math, since the beginning of the 21st century, grades one to three passes accounted for 24.8% math. Physics, 48.8%. Chemistry, 47.1%. It's only biology that has above, for the core science area, above a 50% pass at grades 1 to 3. Some of this, if not all, can be attributed to the shortages of trained teachers at the secondary level. There again, the data is showing that between the urban-rural divide, in urban secondary schools, the student-trained teacher ratio is 32-1. The untrained teacher to student ratio is 41-1. You take it over the rural side, 34-1 and 49-1. So there's also a disparity in urban-rural divide, a disparity between the urban-rural divide. Now, Guyana is known for a country, it's one of the which is a major exporter of trained teachers. And there's no study available yet to show the empirical reason behind this. But anecdotal evidence suggests that better salaries offered abroad is one of the major pull factors. Now, we have reached a point where retreating from youth is not an option because it has implication for the accomplishment of MDG 2. And this makes imperative us finding a solution. And one such solution lies in the use of ICT, because as it's stated there, information and communication technology is at the center of education delivery. And the question is, how can we use ICT to support teacher-centered mode of education delivery? One such method we can use is computer-assisted instruction, which is the method of instruction in which the computer is used to instruct the student and where the computer contains the instruction, which is designed to teach, guide and test the student until a desired level of proficiency is attained. And there are several studies that are attested to the pedagogical viability of CHI. CHI's main strength lies in its multimedia capabilities. And as a result, it can enhance learners' capacity to understand concepts that they previously could not grasp. And with its full range of media, it can complement text and static images by combining audio, video, and animation that provides learners with a richer learning environment that can provide greater support and develop deeper understanding. It also helps you to understand concepts that are dynamic and even concepts that are too small to be observed by the eyes. So what are some of the opportunities for the use of computer-assisted instruction? Now, bear in mind that computer instruction can be accessed from a distance. And as a result, there's no limitation being placed on the student in terms of geography, in terms of time, in terms of the school day. And as a result, bearing out of that can be the enhancing of quality and efficiency. Quality going back to the multimedia capability of CHI, and efficiency getting more within the same time. That the student can learn at home and beyond the 5 days school days. And yet another opportunity is a reduction between the urban-rural divide in terms of inequality and exclusion. Because once you can access the instruction from home, then there's a tendency in Guyana where trained teachers are less inclined to work in rural communities for infrastructural reasons and so forth. And yet another opportunity is greater inclusion, in that students who cannot attend formal secondary schools, be it for religious reasons, financial reasons, cultural, stand the opportunity not to be excluded from accessing quality secondary education. But bear in mind that the intention of CHI is not to replace, but rather to support teacher-centered mode of instruction. But what happens is that the role of the teacher changes from that of the sole possessor and key instructor to that of a facilitator. And therefore, as learning becomes student-centered, the single teacher can attend effectively to more students than previously. What are some of the strengths or support for the introduction of CHI in Guyana? Now, the strength can be had or can be found in two broad policy framework of Guyana, which is basically the National ICT for Development Strategy and the Ministry of Education strategic document. And those are some of the elements of the National ICT for Development Strategy. Time is against us, so you can take a quick glance at it. These are for the support or for the strengths that can be had from or taken from or found in the Ministry of Education strategic document 2008-2013. And this is yet more. So what are some of the weaknesses in the introduction of CHI in the secondary education system? The first, infrastructural, in that internet connectivity in Guyana remains low in terms of broadband internet. In 2007, broadband penetration was a mere 2.62 per every 100 inhabitants. Yet another problem is tele density. With respect to landline access to that 14.9 lines per 100 persons, which is far below the Caribbean and Latin American level of 18.1. Yet another weakness is a human capacity issue, the shortage of trained teachers, which is more than not systemic in the sense that at the training colleges, the teachers training college, and even at the University of Guyana, there is a minimal offering of specialist area in terms of ICT and education delivery. Yet another weakness is financial capacity. In Guyana, for the past four, going back to 2003, GDP as a, education as a percent of GDP remains more than not fixated at 7%. And there's a heavy reliance on external funding. So what are some of the threats for the reintroduction, or the introduction of CHI? Migration. Migration can be a threat in the sense that if you improve the quality of teacher by training them to deliver education using ICT, then you improve the product that we export best, which are trained teachers. Second, the erosion of student-teacher relationship. In the sense that the teachers lose the interface that is occasioned when you teach face-to-face is removed if not removed, and the teacher loses his or her ability to control the class. Last, cultural intrusion in education delivery. And this has to do with the absence of local capacity to develop local materials, local educational program, and the eventuality of having to resort to foreign programs. So what are some of the policy recommendations? First, follow through on the policy decision as enshrined in the National ICT for Development Strategy and the Ministry of Education Strategic Plan 2008-2013. Study the successes of other countries with the view of adopting a similar strategy regarding CHI. Further the liberalization of communication services in Guyana to expand a window of access to modern ICT technologies in the suburban and rural interior regions. Consider offering majors in ICT at the CPCE, which is the Teachers Training College, and the University of Guyana. And last, pursue more and consolidate existing public-private partnerships in the delivery of secondary education using ICTs. Thank you.
Thank you, and I dare say that is probably the best presentation of the day. Exactly 15 minutes. So we'll move on to Dr. Searles. Yes, sir. Who will talk on rethinking post-secondary technical/vocational training for the 21st century.
Not moving. It's giving trouble. Sorry. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. As the moderator has indicated, my presentation today will be taking a look at post-secondary technical vocational training in Trinidad and Tobago specifically. And I am trying to challenge that perhaps now is the an opportune time for us to revisit exactly what TVET means within our country and its role in sustainable development. Basically, this research is part of a larger study that would have been done, and it is born out of a desire to take a critical look at technical vocational training in Trinidad and Tobago, because it is often posited as one of the mechanisms to deal with at-risk youths within the country. And here we are defining at-risk youths as persons who would have left the formal education system without attaining any full CXE passes, so they are educationally disadvantaged. Right. So by way of introductions, it is given in the research that TVET is often advocated as a way to ensure that disadvantaged persons within any society has a plausible chance of getting employment. And as such, governments tend to invest in those youths who would have had little or no educational qualifications after leaving the formal system. Trinidad and Tobago is no different, and as such, the government has invested huge sums of money towards providing post-secondary youth with vocational training opportunities so as to increase their marketability and employment in the world of work. And in terms of our labor market, we recognize that 45.2% of the nation's unemployed are actually represented by that 15 to 24 age cohort, although they only represent 21% of the labor market. Despite the long history of vocational training in Trinidad and Tobago, which could be heralded back to the institution of the Board of Industrial Training in 1906, and the huge sums of money that would have been invested year after year, the TVET sector still is faced with a number of challenges. We have numerous programs and initiatives that are often duplicating the training that is offered, so that whether you go to Servol, CCC, MUS, HIVE, YTEP, which are some of our initiatives, you will be offered the same level of training in the same vocational areas. And therefore, since there's a critical overlap in terms of what is offered and who is targeted, there's evidence emerging that there's a level of poaching that has started to happen in terms of trainees and the facilities that the different institutions are using, as well as the teaching staff. Additionally, there's little or no rigorous implementation of a national standards for quality control of program content delivery and curricula, right? And most of the programs at the national and the state level are operating with dated mandates. They would have been initiated in light of a need that was flagged, and they would have begun to operate. And since then, they have not paused to take a look at whether their mandate is still in existence and what flexibility needs to happen. And in terms of what they stated that they were going to do in terms of increasing the employability of at-risk post-secondary youth, what we are seeing is that the labor market continues to show a persistent vacancies in certain areas and a flood of available bodies in others. Right? Within the programs themselves, at the government level, that is the government-sponsored program, we are seeing that the attrition rates within those programs are sometimes between 17 to 25%. And despite the long history and the amount of persons who are coming out, graduating out of this program, the society is still perceived as having a negative view of what TVET is and the kind of person who should be doing TVET. And therefore, I decided to take a look at one of the largest national vocational training program in the country and look specifically to see what were the motivations, expectations, and the needs of the persons targeted by that program, to see if there was a match between what the institution was in fact doing and the desires and expectations of the trainees, and then to finally do an evaluation to determine how effectively they were in fact fulfilling the mandates that they themselves would have stated in terms of increased employability and marketability of at-risk youth. So I utilized a number of qualitative data collection methods, and I did a series of focus group sessions with trainees who would have graduated, as well as those who would have attrished out of the program, to figure out what their motivations were. And this is a synopsis of what we found. Basically, personal development was the main motivation for entering into the vocational training. They were not really interested in it as a career move or as an occupational option. They were more trying to buy them their time while they were in between repeating CXC or getting a job, right? There was just a few of them were saying yes, they knew that they could use the vocational training for wage employment, but still, that was just a backup plan. They still desired mainstream jobs, which would have been behind the desk, office job, secretarial. They still desired that, regardless of what their academic performance would have been in the past. Few of them indicated that they were interested in opening some business with their skill in the future, but that was a long way off and wasn't an immediate reality to them. They, however, did recognize that having a certificate in a vocational area was going to be an advantage to them. But again, because personal development was the main thrust of their starting the program, it wasn't certification, wasn't a primary objective. Again, because it was not something that they felt that they would be doing year after year for the rest of their lives as a career, they tend to select their courses in a very ad hoc manner. You'll go in and you'll join a course that your friend was doing. Or you'll go in and say, okay, I'm going to go and do early childcare attendant, and that class is full, so I will do hairdressing instead. So it wasn't a firm desire to say, this is what my aptitude is, this is what my desire is, and therefore I enroll in that course. However, based on their past academic performance within the former school system and going through and navigating the technical vocational course, they felt a growing level of self-esteem and pride and confidence because they realized, okay, I'm not as badly off as I originally thought or people thought. I'm actually able to learn something and could apply the skills that I have learned. Even though they desired mainstream jobs, what was surprising to me was that they still set a limit in terms of their aspirations. So when you asked, okay, where do you see yourself in the next 5 years? Where do you see yourself in the next 10 years? You will have them all pegging pre-craft and craft level positions. So you'll say, okay, I want to be a vendor, I want to be a shopkeeper, I want to be a salesman, I want to be a maxi taxi driver. But you wouldn't have them aspiring for anything above a certain level, right? And they again confirmed that in their own experience, society looked at them as less than persons who would have come out of the formal education system with their academic qualifications intact. In terms of the alignment between the desires of the trainees and the institution, this table gives a breakdown. There was obviously a need for career guidance because people did not know all the, they knew they didn't do well in secondary school, but they didn't know what they want to do next, right? And despite that clear demand, the institution that was evaluated had no system for that. Likewise, vocational guidance to say, okay, if you are strong in this area, perhaps auto electrical is something for you to kind of guide to say, okay, to help them say, after you do this pre-craft, this level one course, you can now go on to level two and then go on to a diploma. There was no system to give that kind of guidance to the trainees. Personal development in that, why I have it as a mismatch there is because the trainees, the vast majority of them, were there for just hobby, entertainment, keeping themselves occupied, and that was not a mandate that was even identified by the training institution. Employment is partial because only some of the trainees were interested in using the vocational skills that they were exposed to for employment. Entrepreneurship, yes, because it was mandatory once you had enrolled in the course that you were supposed to do a micro-entrepreneurship component. That would have served well for all those candidates who would have said, yes, sometime way down in the future, I would eventually have a business of my own. Right. And then there was a definite match between the psychological and the life skill development between what the institution was trying to give and what the trainees desired for themselves. In terms of the labor market effectiveness, what we did is we applied a statistical analysis to compare the cohort that would have been enrolled and graduated out of the program successfully against those who were the same demographics who would never have participated in the technical vocational training. And we looked at the difference in terms of their rate of employment, the occupational tier that they were working on, and the income. And as the table indicates, In terms of employment rate, there was no statistical difference between those who participated in technical vocational training and those who did not, right? In terms of occupational and income, however, there was a statistical difference. As in, having gone through the training, they were able to secure higher level jobs and therefore gain more income. Again, comparing what was the institution was doing for effectiveness, we looked at the skill, the labor market, demands of the country against what would have been offered and the numbers being supplied by the institution. And we found that yes, the institution was putting out candidates in the areas that the vacancies existed. However, there was a serious disparity in terms of the numbers of persons being put out annually and the vacancies that actually existed. So yes, they needed plumbers, but the labor market would say, okay, we need 116 plumbers to deal with this project. But the institution was churning out 600 every cycle, which was every 6 months, of plumbers. So there was still going to be a glut in terms of the supply. Recommendations. Based on what we saw in the data, we would like to advocate that there needs to be a reevaluation of the assumptions that simply providing technical vocational training is automatically going to mean that persons with low educational qualifications will get jobs. We need to be honest about that because the data is not showing that. There needs to be an accurate link between the vocational training and the actual labor market needs. So if it is that there's a saturation of this vocational area, revise. Come up with something else where there is a existing gap. There needs to be clear policies for screening out the persons who are truly interested in technical vocational training for occupational purposes and those who are just biding time and entertaining themselves. The training institutions need to be flexible and adaptive to the changing needs of their clients. There has to be a system to allow for career guidance and stuff, because chances are the institution is probably the only resource that they will have to properly guide them in terms of their career options in the future. And in terms of youth entrepreneurship, there needs to be a closer inspection of that whole phenomenon, because while the institution was in fact doing it and the trainees were interested in it, it wasn't something that they were actively pursuing in the immediate to short term. Thank you. 15 minutes.
I now believe that this session should have gone on earlier today. Then we would have been on track with time, right? I suppose the fascinating thing about sustainable development is that, as a matter of fact, I had that little conversation around lunch. And I suppose there has been two schools of thought in the literature that basically the definition of sustainable development is so wide and all-encompassing that probably we need to redefine it and make it a little bit tighter. And then there's the other school of thought that, you know, because it's so broad, that is what probably gives it its mass appeal. And I'm an engineer by profession, so the course I did this semester was Engineering for Sustainable Development. So my focus is normally on engineering response, or as an engineer, what's your role in the whole issue of sustainable development? But here I am, chairing a session on stem cell innovation and education and public policy. So I guess that's the beauty of a conference like this. We have about 5 to 10 minutes for questions. If you have any burning issues, raise your hands and we'll just address them as you ask the question. I won't wait. There's a question there. Marcy, I think.
It's not really a question. It's just directed toward Patrice's work. Patrice, you had mentioned that you didn't use the word, but articulation was difficult because people coming out of vocational courses don't really know what other courses they could go to and if they could go up into degrees and so on. Back in 2008, the ACTT, Accreditation Council for Trinidad and Tobago, they had brought down some people from the Scottish Quality Assurance Company, and they were talking about credit rating systems. So that is something that if you are not finished with your study, it might help with your study, in that you could see how far they have reached in terms of looking at parity levels between vocational training and academic training, and seeing what we call in the NTA the bridges and ladders system, how you could go across in related areas or how you could go up to higher levels in your skill area.
Sure.
Okay, thank you for the comment. I am aware of the work that the NTA is doing as well as the Accreditation Council. However, I'm still seeing the framework that they're working out in the distant future, because as it is right now, we have not been able to even articulate what certificates mean on a post-secondary level to equate them. And we need to do that first before we begin to equate it to what is happening in the formal education system to get the credits and stuff. I know that we are on the way, but in the interim, we have a number of persons who are coming out with certificates and that mean different things to the stakeholder, and that is the reality as it is right now. But I'm keeping my fingers crossed too for the success of NTA.
Okay, one more question.
A question is
comment.
A comment based on the tech work. Actually, I work at our community college, and in terms of the technical education, there was a stigma attached to the technical education, but right now, it has definitely changed. First of all, it's the same entry requirements as the A's, and actually, most students are now opting for the technical education than A's. We actually are not able to, students who actually qualify for the technical division, because of space, we are not able to actually to take them all in. And I think, as you just said, many persons who are skeptical about technical, saying that it's only for those who are not educationally inclined. But we have also realized that, I guess the students have realized that as well. I mean, maybe I'm speaking from, maybe I have a bias because, you know, but I feel strongly on that particular issue, because as you said, with the technical education, you are able to, if you're not able to actually go in the workforce, you can actually have your own business and so. So positively for St. Lucia, that stigma is positively being erased.
Okay. Any more burning questions? Don't let me have to ask, what is stem cell? Any other questions? Yeah, I think you guys are just probably saturated, right? All right, thanks a million for your attention, and thanks to you guys for keeping good time this time around.